Bernie or bust.
Yeah, Bernie or bust. Bill Clinton was actually in the media tent after the vote yesterday. He was very upset.
Yeah, I heard also that the theory was that what y'all don't understand is that Donald Trump is not a plant for us. Hillary is a plant for Donald Trump.
Hello, Zero Books viewers and readers and listeners. This is an episode technically of Pop the Left, although we are really skipping our usual broadcast or, you know, live stream format. And instead, we're dedicating this space to paying tribute to Michael Brooks. With me here is Derek Varn and Ben Burgess. Probably they're both very familiar to you. And I'm assuming if you're watching this live stream, you also know very well who Michael Brooks was. But just in case you don't, or for future viewers who may come across this video, I thought I'd start by asking Ben to let people know who Michael Brooks was and why he was so important.
Yeah. My hope personally is that in the future it'll be even less likely than it is now that anybody doesn't know the answer to that question. But Michael Brooks was talk show host. He was the the co-host for years and years of the Majority Report. Started in 2017, 2018, started his own show, the Michael Brooks Show, that became very successful. He started a show on Jacobin weekends with Michael Brooks and Anna Kasparian, and relevantly for Zero Books, he wrote a very excellent book called Against the Web, A Cosmopolitan Answer to the New Right. And I guess that's the, that's the bare bones of it. But if you were just hearing that, you would think that I'm describing a podcaster who wrote a book. And, you can't throw a rock in certain neighborhoods of Brooklyn without hitting one of those. So that doesn't really give you a sense of why he was so important to all of us and to so many other people. And as we go on in the discussion, we're going to fill in some of those gaps, but I guess just for now, say that, that he had a personality that connected powerfully, to many people who didn't know him in person. We all did. And he was both one of the funniest. Well, I don't know why I'm fucking around with one of the. He was both the funniest person in left media, and also one of the smartest people in left media, which isn't necessarily a combination you'd always expect. And he was a tremendously thoughtful person who had a lot to say about history and philosophy and this kind of vision that he was developing in the last years of his life of cosmopolitan socialism, which we are going to be talking about in what follows. I think you're muted, Doug.
Yeah, thank you. He was important to so many people, and since he passed, I've come to realize just how many and how many people from all over the world were connected to, influenced by, and supported by, and supporters of Michael Brooks. You're right to just say, well, he did a show and he wrote a book and he was on the left, doesn't begin to cover it. One of the things we'll do in this live stream is discuss his ideas and the way he was developing what he called a cosmopolitan socialism, which I think he would want to be part of his legacy, the further development of that kind of movement. Even though I know that what we can do on this live stream won't compete with what happened on the Majority Report the other day, where there was 4 hours dedicated to people who knew him best and sharing the memories of Michael. I still feel like we should start by also sharing our own, but I would recommend that people who want to really feel the loss, take the time to watch that stream. It was 4 hours long, but in watching the chunks, it was tremendously moving. But again, I'm going to go to you, Ben, to start, because you knew him best of the three of us. Do you want to share a memory of Michael?
I've actually just up until I had to stop because we were about to start the stream. I was, writing a remembrance of him for Jacobin to add to the pile that many people have already written for him there. Since, he meant so much to so many of us, that everybody wants to do that. So I've kind of been swimming in memories of Michael Brooks. I guess I'll just mention a very small one here, which is something that our mutual friend and comrade, Bhaskar Sankara, texted me yesterday. He had been watching the episode of the Michael Brooks Show from last summer that we'd both been on in studio, and he just got into the line. I think it was in the context of arguing about astrology, because Michael would often tease me about astrology, which I don't think he literally believed in. But I think that was his way of kind of teasing me about not being open to, all sorts of things, right? That he was Buddhist spirituality and, certain, existential psychology and things like that. But in any case, somehow I think that was the moment Bhaskar was quoting that, this maybe had come up, and both Bhaskar and myself, made some sort of awkward or skeptical comments. And he said, guys, don't bring that nerd shit to my show.
Yeah. This is one of the things that is weighing heavily on me as we do this live stream. Is I know that if there is an afterlife, or if there's any way that Michael Brooks is looking down on us right now, he's just going like this. Oh God, the nerds are doing the tribute now.
I definitely... When I was describing him at the top, when I caught myself saying one of the funniest people in left media, I could definitely feel what his reaction would have been if he'd been.
What do you mean one of? Derek, do you want to share a memory?
Well, I mean, I was going to talk about how we all met, Michael in person in Boise. But before that, actually, I was doing symptomatic redness, and he had come on and he wanted to talk to me because I was one of the people who could push back on some of the social democratic stuff without being like
an asshole.
Well, I mean, I could be an asshole, but
like a victimized asshole or something.
Yeah, like a victimized asshole who also thought that just Democrats are always bad. And I mean, and just repeat through like Jimmy Dore talking points, in like Stalin makeup. But, and at the end of that interview, when we were talking to him, I was talking to him about, the first Sanders movement at the time, because this was right before the second Sanders movement was really going to start kicking off in earnest. And I told him that I was beginning to lose passion for, doing the left-wing commentary, particularly in the kind of minute level that I was doing it. And he told me he told me specifically you need to keep this up because people like me need people like you to give them a little bit of crap to make their ideas better. And I don't know, it was kind of a boost. When we met, in Boise, I remember the panel that we did together, Doug. It was you, me, and Michael. And like at one point, you were talking about like how you didn't think there was like a vast right wing media conspiracy. And Michael and I just looked at each other and then looked at you, confused.
That's not an accurate depiction of what I said at all. I said I didn't think that you could blame a vast right-wing media conspiracy for all of the failures of the left, and that way it was overestimated or overblown. Anyway, this is our relationship. This is Derek and my relationship.
But no, Michael was a good ally. He would also defend you against me when I was being a total prick. So, you know, there's that.
Yeah, there's that.
on a personal level, though, like, you know, Michael and I hadn't seen each other, and his show started to explode. I came on it once to talk about strategy because we both love, we love like John Gaddis and Robert Greene, and like this, like a mixture of like just people who go through the classics and deduce strategy and trying to talk about how that might work now. For socialism and also for self-improvement. I was at a pretty low point in the, after the show, he could tell. He reached out to me because I think he, at the time, I mean, it wasn't public knowledge, but, like my marriage was ending. So like he was a good enough listener to pick that up from an appearance on a show and like check in on me a couple weeks later and really get me to like talk about it a little bit. And that was on top of everything else he did. I mean, he really did take this idea of personal loyalty and of like hate the game, not the player, to a deep level where there was actually some care for him, where he didn't have to do it. It wasn't just instrumental. And that really, really meant something to me. And I told him later that like, you know, hey, I think some of your socialism's a little milquetoast, but like, I'm glad you're doing it because I think you're really not trying to grift people. You believe this. And you're the right person to do it. And even if I don't always agree with you politically, that I have faith that you are going to build something good. And I was really watching what he was building. And so that's kind of my memory of him. I mean, we weren't like best friends. I don't want to make it sound like we were, but like we would talk semi-regularly and he would kind of keep up. He also would help out, you know, people with even lower profile than me, my friend JG Michaels, who was really beginning at the time. I mean, just starting out and podcasting, whatnot, like before he had any audience, Michael Brooks showed up. It was just a grace to help someone start off. Mm-hmm. And he didn't have to do that. And he totally did it and did it with grace and aplomb. So like, you know, I can't say anything bad about the man.
No. And certainly not on his memorial tribute stream. Phaedrus just threw $5 at us through super chat. I thank you very much for that. I want people to know that if they use the super chat, I'm going to keep track of the money we collect and it will go to Michael's Patreon, or it will go to the foundation directly, depending on what is easier to do when we get it all together. But so I'm not going to discourage people from doing that. An alternative to doing that would just be to go and directly contribute to Michael's Patreon instead. And that will skip the middleman. It will skip paying YouTube money and then Patreon money. you can just pay Patreon and then Michael Brooks people money. So I have my memory of Michael too. I met him in New York before I met him in Idaho. You know, I it was great fun. I went out and had beers with him, and everyone at the bar knew him, and of all types, different kinds of people came up to say congratulations on your show today, and because he came to the bar after his show, and I was impressed to be, you know, hanging out with him from the first time I met him. But what I remember most about him was the fact that he was relentless with his impressions. that after we all met in Idaho, he developed a number of impressions of me, of some of the other people there. And, you know, we had lots of conversations, drank several beers, although he wasn't a big drinker. I dragged him along anyway. And, but the one that I remember the most was he did an impression of Jordan Sheridan, who was at the time had just been let go from the Young Turks. There was been a scandal and we were just talking about it. And he did this impression of Jordan Sheridan, which I found so funny that he would sometimes like call me up out of the blue and just do this Jordan Sheridan impersonation again and again, even if I would tell him to stop, because I would never stop laughing at it. So he would keep doing it as often as he could get a laugh, which was almost indefinitely. And it went something like, I'm Jordan Sheridan, and I'm reporting on the Flint, Michigan water crisis from a hot tub in my suite at the airport Best Western. What I've discovered today is not only do the people in Flint, Michigan not have access to clean water, but they're also deprived of the full understanding of the benefits of polyamory. I'm here with two interns and a bottle of brut champagne to try to make up for everything that was denied to me in high school. And, you know, I'm not doing the impression, but that was basically the outline of Michael Brooks' impression of Jordan Sheridan, which was cruel and relentless and hilarious. And he was sometimes like that, and in the very best way. I mean, he was kind of famous for his Islamic Barack Obama
which
impersonation.
It says something about how funny he was. And sorry, I just had a moment about putting that in the past tense, but how funny he was and how charismatic he was and how obvious it was that he was coming from a good place, that as a white guy, he could for years do yeah. one of his best beloved bits, Barack Obama saying shit about white devils, and, you know, everybody loved it and nobody was ever offended by it.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, and unlike our channel, which has a tendency to be way too white in the guest list, he had, you know, a huge array of people, a lot of people from the black community in the United States, people from around the world, including Africa. And he would do that stuff. He didn't care who was in the guest chair when he would do that stuff.
Yeah.
And it never caused any problems with, well, I mean, it caused some problems for the right wingers who were actually, he was lampooning, but it didn't ever offend anybody on his show. So the other thing I wanted to go over was just what he was as far as a collaborator and a colleague and kind of an ally to Zero Books, because writing a book for us was, I mean, it was helpful for him, but it was also very helpful for us writing, contributing, you know, as much as he did to our podcast and on our YouTube channel. Again, it was a collaboration and we were both scratching each other's backs, but he was certainly helping us out. He had me on his show a few times, and I know you got a regular gig on the show, Ben. But one of the things he would do is actually we would talk every once in a while about like what was going on behind the scenes. What is your strategy for how you're navigating the left media world, and, you know, what do you think about? Often enough, it's just gossip, but he recommended that I read a book called 48 Rules for Power by Robert Greene.
Yeah.
Because he thought, well, you signed on to that as well. You know, just to sort of make me into a man, I think I should read this book. I was looking through the rules today, just to kind of in preparation for this. What it struck me was how many of the rules he never followed.
Which to be fair, I do remember Michael saying that if you actually followed all of these all the time, you'd be a complete asshole.
right.
You'd be so sociopathic, you actually wouldn't be successful.
Right. And also that you couldn't actually follow them all because they would at times contradict each other.
Right.
But I just thought I'd go through, like, I have seven of them written down. Like, one of the very first rule is never outshine the master. Now, I've watched the Majority Report, and Sam Cedar is a talented guy, I guess, you know. But I would not say that it would have been possible for Michael not to compete with him and at times outshine him. And I remember the very first Michael Brooks show that he did, he said, you know, I just want to say, you know, something like, you know, my condolences go out to Sam. You know, it must be very hard for him to watch me pass him by.
Yeah. Same, you know, which was also awesome, you know, because like when you watch those interactions, like, you know, along the lines of the same subject we're just talking about, Michael Sam Cedar impression. let's put it this way. Had Michael been a Gentile, I don't know if it would have played differently.
Right.
But it was both out of context. It was both, you know, personally offensive and like wildly anti-Semitic. And every time you watch, and he would do it in front of him all the time, right? every time you see him do it, right? Since Sam has a background in stand-up, so he knows enough to know that the last thing he should do is give energy to this bit by reacting to it in any way.
Right.
He just
pretends. Especially with Michael. You give him any energy at all, and that bit will not end. That's the thing about Michael. But anyway, keep going. I'm sorry. I guess maybe I cut you off at the right moment. But the next one on the list, never put too much trust in friends.
He was bad at that one.
Yeah. No, yeah, totally.
Sucked at that. I was just watching the video from the conference in Idaho of the talk I gave there, because I wanted to find the moment where Michael interjects, you know, in the middle, and which thus failing, at least if I'm going to be arrogant about my role there, failing the outshining rule. And then, especially when he does his like Kermit the Frog, Jordan Peterson impression during the Q&A. And also asked a really smart question, right? But he, right. And then, you know, without necessarily going into details, one of the impressions he was working up over that weekend, he severely violated the don't place too much trust in friends rule, because this was a not for public consumption impression that 2 days after I met him, he emailed me an MP3 version of.
Right. Yeah. I got that email too. And I don't know if I still have that MP3, but I'll say it was an impersonation of me, and I certainly won't be releasing it. So the next thing on the list here is conceal your intentions. Did he ever conceal his intentions to anyone?
Ever. Absolutely. No. Not. He, you know, I mean, he would, you know, I mean, it's something I've thought about a lot of the last few days, you know, that like he had this way of being very like, frankly, you know, like frankly ambitious in a way that wasn't, and, you know, the fact that I hesitated to use that word for a second shows that I'm just a typical leftist cuck who doesn't, you know, who has conflicted feelings about that. Right. But he didn't, right. At all. Right. Like he, I mean, he would, you know, make a joke of it, right? That like he'd you know, he'd say things like he judged human beings by whether they were TMBS patrons, you know. That's
right.
But you know, but I mean, like, I think that the deeper thing there, right, is he correctly understood that pursuing personal excellence and ambition in what you do is a good thing. That it's that, you know, no matter how often we might hear it weaponized by the right to, you know, to blame the victims of economic inequality, you know, even in an advanced post-scarcity socialist society, we would actually want people, right, to strive for excellence in all the things they're doing with their lives, and you know, and win basketball tournaments and develop, you know, pandemic vaccines and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And you know, and he, you know, he was every bit as ambitious on behalf of his friends and political allies as he was on behalf of himself. God knows I, you know, probably benefited from that maybe more than anybody. You know, I mean, I certainly know how much I owe to him. And I think even on a deeper level, maybe, like, you know, especially because he did grow up in sometimes pretty rough circumstances. You know, he's talked about this, you know, times when his family was, you know, evicted, or, you know, kind of had formative experiences seeing his mom, you know, buy groceries with the bridge card and things like that. You know, I think he had a deep understanding that trying to live up to every ounce of his potential in his own media career not only wasn't in tension with the political project that career served, but was a very natural fit with striving to create a society in which nobody is stopped by poverty or inequality or powerlessness from living up to the fullest flourishing of whatever their potential was.
Yeah. Actually, I'm thinking about one of the conversations we had that was really meaningful was about this exactly, because we were talking about, I think it was at the Jordan Peterson conference, and then it spread over a couple of weeks afterwards. And we were talking about how seeding self-help ideas as inherently right-wing was actually disempowering people. And we kind of Michael and I kind of bonded over a similar rough background, you know, and we talked about how so much of that enabling, frankly, was like middle-class affectation that was condescending to poor people. And it kind of pissed us both off, like, deeply. You know, that was a big theme. I mean, I know when we would talk about certain controversial issues that I won't name because I don't want us to get sidetracked into that, but that was a big theme. It's like, quit patronizing us and quit saying that we can't make a better world, because we also, but you know, and we can't make ourselves better. We can do both, and we have to do both. In fact, you know, Michael agreed with me that it was a moral imperative to do both. Like, to help people, you needed to be strong. And like, Michael was really good at bringing other people up. As you said, he was great at it. And he was also great at like making sure that some of us who were just about to be like, you know, I'm burned out, I'm done, just didn't just quit. Mm-hmm.
Something I've heard from so many people, different people the last few days, is that they've like kind of gone through their text message histories with Michael, and they've seen like 20 times that they couldn't now reconstruct the context, you know, because who knows, right? You know, if it's from months ago, just random messages from him saying, you know, hang in there, bro, you know, you get through this, you know. Because, you know, he did that a lot. And absolutely. And I also feel, I mean, not only am I obviously a beneficiary of his, you know, of his going to bat so hard for me in so many ways, you know, but I also feel, you know, like I'm a huge beneficiary of just like some of that, you know, from knowing him so well for the last couple of years of his life, you know, some of that Michael Brooks constant hustle rubbing off on me, you know, that like, you know, God, you know, I'm in 2017, you know, I could like maybe get it together to like, you know, write an article and send it to Counterpunch once every 3 months, you know, that you know, but I think just knowing him and the fact that I would always, you know, have these conversations all the time with him about different opportunities and stuff, you know, helped, you know, make me a little bit more like he is, which is a good way to be.
I'm going to move on to the next part of this list. It says, always say less than is necessary.
No comment.
Michael followed that one. So much depends on reputation. Make your reputation unassailable. You know, I think he did that.
Actually done that one. Yeah.
Yeah. That might be the first one he followed.
Yeah. And I'm maybe not so intentionally, but I mean, he was concerned about his reputation as everyone, you know, who does media work would be, but the way he solidified his reputation was by reaching out to people, being loyal to people. I mean, I always knew that he would be loyal to me. I didn't expect him to, continue to necessarily always write for Zero Books or to remain at the level that we're at. I mean, because I feel like Zero Books may grow, but not anywhere near as fast as Michael Brooks' career was going to. But I always knew that he would, and he said it. He didn't hide his intentions, right? So he said, "Yeah, no, don't worry. I'll always be able to. I always have time to come back on your podcast. You know, I'm not going to just. I'm not going to become too cool for you guys."
I think also, I mean, I guess it's also important maybe to use a nerd word to disambiguate the sense in which he cared about his reputation and the sense in which he didn't, because it definitely didn't take the form of like not saying things he thought were true, you know, because like people wouldn't like it. Right.
Well, that's not a power move. So why would you do that?
That would be very not alpha, but very small example, and I don't want to sidetrack into any sort of controversy, but like a couple weeks ago, right, when he was interviewing Stavros from Cumtown on TMBS, something I've told Doug is that if I had to accurately and evocatively summarize TMBS for somebody who'd never seen it before, I would my one sentence version would be recent guests have included Stavi from Cumtown and Cornel West. But in that conversation, right, it sort of came up. It's like, oh yeah, people are really mad at Noam Chomsky, you know, right now, because he signed this free speech letter and the way he charged through that and just dismissed with contempt the concern, right? You know, like was definitely, whatever you think about the issue, was definitely not the action of somebody who's like sitting around worrying about, you know, whether leftists will think that he has bad takes. right. But I think maybe what, you know, part of the reason his reputation, you know, was so golden and you've seen all this, whatever. I mean, the evidence that is everywhere in the last few days is that even though there were definitely positions he took that clearly big chunks of his audience disagreed with, right? I mean, there's no doubt about that. But I think that part of the reason they maybe didn't tend to get that mad at him about it when it happened, beyond just the fact that he had this tremendously, you know, appealing personality, is just that it was always so evident that, like, you know, he wasn't being a contrarian. He wasn't, you know, like he wasn't trying to, you know, to stir shit to get people to pay attention. Right. You know, that like he always, to quote somebody who he disagreed with about some of these things, right. You know, Nathan Robinson in his piece that just came out today, right. Said, you know, you could, said something that was very true, right? Which is that you could always tell that he'd actually thought about it, right? You know, before he said what he said. And just to add on to Nathan's point, it was always evident that this tremendous, sincere emotional investment in the struggle for a better world was always behind whatever he was saying.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things, if we want to tie this into cosmopolitan socialism, because it actually is directly related, that Brooks really seemed to believe that a lot of we conflated a lot of systemic issues into personalities. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the times, like, you know, he would say to me, like, maybe I shouldn't actually. Okay. He would say to me that, like, you know, Goldman Sachs doesn't care what race you are or who you sleep with if your money's good. Like, and I would be like, yeah, I mean, and he actually also really, like, to bring it back to that quote about hating, you know, like, be tough on systems, be kind to people. Mm-hmm. The reason why he believed that is, like, we could get into this fury of self-righteousness, even when we're right. I mean, even if we're objectively correct about a person, in a way that makes reintegration impossible. And he's like, that's a non-starter, that, you know, you can't achieve, like, you know, anything if your entire social functioning is always pushing people out. And, you know, and he really resented the, you know, the intellectual dark web for weaponizing that mistake. Yeah. You know, and for me now, like, it wasn't just an idea for him. It was like a life orientation for him. Mm-hmm. And that's absolutely why he cared about it.
Yeah. I think that's one of the reasons why, again, going back to the power rules, because I like frameworks and things. That's why his reputation was so good, was because he did follow that rule. And but also because he was so, as I said before, it's because he was so tremendously loyal to people. And because he didn't, like, one of the things that he did that wouldn't get clicks and that wasn't necessarily the smartest move in terms of an easy trajectory for success was focus on international affairs, bring people on who weren't necessarily personalities who would be talking about things that his audience didn't know about from the start and wasn't immediately important to their lives. But he cared deeply about that. And everybody who worked with him knew that. And, you know, he was reliable for those of his friends who were from other parts of the world and engaged in other struggles. You know, someone asked me what's going to happen now on the American left to support the Kurds. Now that Michael's gone, who's going to be doing that work? It's a good question. I think it's a task for us all to try to pick up some of that slack.
Yeah. The other thing is, he always, on international issues, his voice was really his conscience. He was never one of, because unfortunately, a lot of the times on the left and on the right too, when you hear people who are observed with particular international issues, it's because they're kind of on someone's payroll. And that was never true with Michael. He would also know about things that, like I could debate with him about specific reforms in Brazil, or like that we disagreed about, or like stuff going down in Peru. And frankly, almost no one else on the left can talk to me about that stuff ever. And so it was refreshing because A, I knew his opinion on was his. He wasn't on the take on any of that. And B, that he did that because he cared about it. And C, he actually bothered to learn. Hmm.
So here's the next rule. Do you have something more?
No, another rule. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, it's definitely the case that that rather than picking topics, you know, like he did 20 episodes in a row or something at Brazil when nobody but him was talking about that, right? Like rather than picking topics that people are already interested in, he counted on his talent, you know, to make them interested in them, you know, which as you say, is a harder road, but one, you know, one he was very successful in, and he was, you know, for all the, you know, for all the kind of, you know, posturing that he'd sometimes do about, you know, about like, oh, I don't know what all this nerd shit you're talking about is or whatever. he read deeply on everything, right? Every time, you know, I was over at his place, like I'd always see, you know, like what book was open, you know, to halfway point or whatever in the apartment. And like, you know, he had somebody like Harvey J.K. or Richard Wolff, you know, on, and, you know, got interested enough in them to have them on a few times. You know, he would go back and he would read everything, you know, that they'd written, and, you know, and he could, you know, he could talk, yeah, knowledgeably about, you know, all kinds of, you know, liberation movements in the global South, especially, and a lot of, you know, a lot of other, like, I mean, the range of things.
You know what I could never get him to read is the D&D monster manual.
Okay, so, well, anyway. I'll give you that.
So, yeah, he's giving me a lot of trouble. His next rule, court attention at all costs.
Well, maybe on that one.
I think he,
I don't know.
Not at all costs, but he was good at courting attention. And this is one. This last one's for. Go ahead.
Oh no! I just did want to let it go. Somebody in the chat asked me about this. I do indeed still teach in Hotlanta, as they asked. But I'm cautiously optimistic they're going to let me teach online in the fall. So, you know, I don't contribute to killing any students' grandparents, but we'll see.
The same here. I don't still teach in Hotlanta, but still. Although I am from Georgia, so you know.
So the last power rule is win through actions and never through arguments. And
he argued a lot.
Yeah, argued quite a bit.
Yeah.
That debug segment that was his idea, right? Like right. I thought that I was going to go on a show once or twice to promote the book, and it was going to be that, right? I mean, like, that's something he dreamed up. So the man, you know, as much as it might cut into his interest in not being perceived as a nerd, actually was very interested in arguments.
Right. But I think he liked winning arguments for winning the argument for the sake of that. He thought it was strong to be able to win those arguments. He kind of understood the idea that by giving up logical argumentation, the left was also giving up power, that right. there's a power to having the better argument. But yeah, he enjoyed, I think most of all, rigorous understanding, developing a rigorous understanding, not necessarily point scoring on, you know, technical little arguments, but like developing a world view understanding.
Like usually his argumentative style, right? He, you know, I mean, look, whatever. Like when he went those times that he'd go on, God, whatever that like Israeli TV channel is, you know, they'd like bring him in to like argue with some weird reactionary with a fake English accent. You know, he'd be pugilistic in that setting, but normally in most cases, right, his default reasoning style was to try to, you know, like after he kind of figured out what he thought was right, you know, to try to think deeply about the other side of the debate and what they might be right about and how that perspective could be synthesized, you know, into what he was talking about. And, you know, sometimes not, right? Sometimes he would even say, hey, look, I think, you know, whatever. I think Adolf Reed is just right about this, like, anti-essentialist stuff or whatever, right? But, like, he was clearly happiest when he could do that kind of dialectical synthesis.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, he also didn't stab anyone in the Majority Report, so that's also a sign that he can make an argument. So, like...
That's true.
He didn't even stab Sargon of Akkad when he was on, but he did run circles around him rhetorically.
Well, that's not, that actually was pretty hilarious when that happened, because a lot of people, a lot of leftists who tried to debate Sargon always gave him way too much.
Yeah.
like way too many premises, and Michael didn't play that shit.
Right. the other thing that we were going to do possibly in this tribute was to talk about his ideas of about cosmopolitan socialism. And when we were talking about the book, you know, one of the things that he was really striding about with me was that he didn't want to just write a book about the intellectual dark web and critiquing them. I mean, I thought that would sell pretty well just in and of itself, but for him, what was important about writing the book was developing this idea of cosmopolitan socialism as an alternative to sort of the nationalist West is best sentiments that are not always on the surface with all of the IDW guys, but are usually in the background or sometimes, you know, quite overt.
To develop an alternative both to that and to the dominant left mode of responding to that, which he felt was not only inadequate but tended to give initiative to their side.
When it came time to promote his book, for a variety of reasons, he was wanting to make sure that part of the promotion would be around the idea of cosmopolitan socialism, and that he didn't end up like making YouTube videos like, you know, Michael Brook crushes the head of Ben Shapiro, or you know, the kind of thing that you would make, Ben.
Not, of course, that Matt and Forrest didn't title plenty of Majority Reported TMBS clips over the years, things like that. You know,
well, right. Well, it's impossible.
They were certainly willing to play the game as far as titles go, but then you watch the segment, right? And it was always smarter than the title would make it sound. And certainly for this, yeah, that was the most important part of the book for him, right? You know, that like the easy part, the worthwhile part, you know, to his mind, because it let him showcase, like, by showing how, you know, historically illiterate and simplistic the IDW guys were, it let him showcase some of what was important to him in terms of, you know, in terms of historicizing and contextualizing things and look at economic systems. But the most important part was the positive vision. You know, that's what he really cared about. And it's the least of the loss, but one of the articles we were supposed to write, you know, was going to be an expansion of this. I'd actually done, you know, the night before he died, you know, I was thinking about, you know, calling him, right, you know, to see if I could, you know, kind of pester him about nailing down a time for a writing session, because I kept saying he wanted to do this article and also one about Michael Manley. And you know, then I thought, yeah, you know, it's getting late, right? You know, I'll wait till tomorrow. That's very, you know, I think it's laid out in a really nice way, you know, in that last chapter. And, you know, he, you know, part of what he means is internationalism, right? Pure and simple, that, you know, just what I think normally socialist people in the Marxist tradition would call internationalism. But I think it also means a little bit more than that. So it's certainly part of what he's interested in, of course, is international working class solidarity. But there's also a cultural component to it, and that word, you know, cosmopolitan, you know, which he went back and forth on a little bit in drafts. But you know, it was important to him because it summed up a lot of what he meant by that, right? Because part of what he was doing was sort of thinking about this like hellscape where, you know, you have this like eternal argument between the likes of Brett Weinstein and the student activists at Evergreen, you know, and like what normal human being wouldn't just say hell with all of them, right? You know, and of course, if you're just reacting to one or the other of those things, it can kind of drive you to the other one. But he wanted, some of it really is just as simple as like to kind of have a cultural vision that, you know, would, that avoided the, um, the, you know, the Rock of being some, you know, like humorless scold who is like telling you not to eat curry because that's cultural appropriation, and the hard place of being a bigot, right? Whether openly or in a IDW, you know, Western civilization is really, you know, blah, blah, blah sort of way, right? You know, that like it was very important to him to show that that you know, human rights are not, you know, democracy, pluralism, you know, these are not, you know, Western concepts. Mm-hmm. You know, find these in all sorts of different traditions. He has an interest in romanticizing those other traditions. His point is that, look, everything good and everything bad is in every culture, and the sort of like healthier way to live together in the way that a, you know, that cosmopolitan, literally like in cities where people are intermingling, right? You know, that is one where we, you know, we kind of, you know, we accommodate each other and we learn and are influenced and shaped, you know, in a natural way by each other's cultural traditions, which, you know, in some ways is even maybe kind of the best vision of capitalism, right? You know, of bourgeois liberalism, right? You know, but I think he felt that could be realized in a deeper way, you know, when combined with socialism.
Well, the one question, what I remember about that, the title of his book was that he did go back and forth. You mentioned it between whether he wanted to write the subtitle as like a call for cosmopolitan socialism, or was it going to be internationalist socialism, or the, you know, or an internationalist perspective. At one point he wanted to use the word globalist because he just thought that would piss off a lot of people and get the right wing all upset if he called himself a globalist. When I talked to him about this, I was sort of against cosmopolitanism as the word, and wanted him to go with something like an internationalist perspective, because I don't know, because I'm a sectarian Marxist wannabe, you know, sectarian Marxist, and
That's not true. I think he's indoctrinated some of his kids.
Well, yeah, that's true.
Oh yeah, sect of five.
sect of four. I
think though part of the problem with the reason why we can't use the term internationalist though is because it's also been used by anti-imperialists in a way that was nationalist in a way that was kind of. That was nationalist for other things in the United States in ways that was romanticizing their past too. And Michael didn't buy into that. And so I didn't talk to him explicitly about this, but he actually thought the baggage of that term, because it's now contested territory, whereas cosmopolitan is kind of broadly understood, was kind of what was at issue. And,
yeah, but cosmopolitanism often enough in the context of American politics is the liberal alternative to socialism. I saw Michael Ben Michaels, I think, debate another professor about whether or not there should be a struggle for socialism or a struggle for cosmopolitanism. And Marx and Engels thought that cosmopolitanism was a bourgeois ideology that reflected the material interests of international capital. But they also thought that the working class was international and that they had material interests that crossed national borders. And the contradiction or the dialectical side of this is that without that bourgeois cosmopolitanism, there wouldn't have been an international working class.
Right.
What are we, I mean, I'm sure this will be something that, the reason I'm bringing it up is like, this would be something that I would bring Michael on to discuss sometime, right? This would be exactly the kind of conversation I'd want to have with him. It's a real conundrum for me. It's like a Chinese finger trap. How do we, on the one hand, build a movement that has a cosmopolitan ethos, but that doesn't sink into the kind of bourgeois cosmopolitanism that would ignore the need to develop working class power.
How do you do any of these things? Because, well, I mean, like, we all agree also that, like, bourgeois whites are good. They're just not enough. Like, right. So I'm not going to cede, like, freedom of speech, freedom of association, any of those things away because they're bourgeois, because they were the only good things the bourgeois probably produced. And in fact, if you like reading the Brumaire, that was one of Marx's infuriation with the regressive turn, say the early French bourgeoisie took, is that they gave up all that stuff as soon as things got hard. And like, to me, that's the same thing with cosmopolitanism. It is objectively a bourgeois ideology. I mean, it's actually even a certain chunk of the bourgeois that would be cosmopolitan against other kinds of bourgeoisie. But it's also an idea that we can't just cede to them. And if we deal with the movement of these terms in history, as like, this is very relevant to Pop the Left, right? That's all we pretty much do is talk about the movement of these terms in history.
Right.
Internationalism has become really, really vague in a way that's hard for people to understand. It can mean in one case, I'm going to support Russia in Syria. In another case, I'm going to support the Kurds, in which case it doesn't give you a guiding principle for anything on geopolitics. Now, why is that? Because it's been weakened over its use in history.
Well, right. Isn't the whole idea of having a stance on geopolitics mostly about trying to, whether you're going to oppose or support something some bourgeois state's doing? It
exactly. I mean, you like, know?
So I mean, in the early days of let's say the 20th century, even my understanding was that there were networks of working class support. There was something more like an actual internationalist socialist movement. And it was easier to understand what internationalism was when you had a movement for taking power for a working class across national boundaries. But now there's barely national movements for working class power.
Go ahead, Ben. No, that's true. Although actually in an interesting way, I mean, whatever, you know, one of the many frustrations of the way that the Anglo-American social democratic wave of, you know, maybe 2015 to 2019 was so thoroughly beaten back is that we were starting to see, so, you know, like a much stronger element of international solidarity in there than you would have expected. And actually also Varn's example, if we just focus in a really granular way on that, is an interesting one as far as what you're talking about, you know, because like if you think about, okay, what are, you know, Russia's doing in Syria, all that, like, you know, there were actually American and British leftists who like literally volunteered to fight Rojava and died in some cases, you know. So
yeah, we lost a couple of people here in Salt Lake to that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, yeah, and it would be like taking a side in the Spanish Civil War, except here also, like, there were people who were actively opposing that, although they weren't going and fighting for
Assad
or for, the Russian military force. To kind of tie it in, we did get a super chat question, so I'll try to respect it. Have any of you read Against the Grain, A Deep History of the Early Estates by James Scott? Yes. I've also read Thinking Like a State by James Scott. It's very useful for these discussions. One of the things that Scott gets to is the class nature of states, and it's something that Marx actually maintains against a lot of like the more Lassallian end of the First International Socialism. But, you know, the internationalism we talk about, one of the things we talked about, Doug, even when we talk about this, is like trying to parse out why Marx thought nationalism was okay in the international, because the First International had explicit nationalist movements. They were fighting empires, and empires in the old, like, you know, Habsburgian sense, not just in the later Lenin fiscalization empire sense, like the, you know, literal multi-ethnic feudal states. Mm-hmm. And so, like, and we are still fighting kinds of imperialism now, but often there is a kind of naive view that just kind of flips the script of imperialism. And Michael seemed to realize that was a problem, like, in ways that made it very clear because he studied international politics and other people's histories, which a lot of people on the left only do through like sectarian education. They don't really go and read a whole
lot. Nothing at all wrong with sectarian education. There are only a few right interpretations in the world, and and my little sect that's put off from a sect that had 5 people in it 10 years ago has the one. And if we haven't written about it, it doesn't matter.
I mean, well, okay, yeah, to be fair, Doug, we've all broken out of sects. I think every one of us here have been in a socialist sect at one point or another.
I claim my sect was the smallest.
Well, I don't know, actually. But,
yeah, that's a tough call.
Yeah.
Vince was the biggest, I think, but...
yeah. Which honestly, you know, I mean, I think is one thing... you know, that might sometimes, you know, account for some, you know, maybe political disagreements, you know, that you guys had with him sometimes. But also, I think what made so much of Michael's perspective so refreshing sometimes is that he came to this perspective on his own, right? Like, in other words, like he, you know, he came to this by, you know, sort of being generally progressive and doing a lot of reading and talking to a lot of people and sort of like getting more and more socialist as he went on. The advantage of which is that his brain was never broken, you know, by the world of American far left sectarianism.
Yeah. And he was never shoved into a locker when he was in high school either.
You know, one of the things that I think we do have to, like, one of the reasons I think international perspective was so important to him, and maybe the cosmopolitan relation to this too, is his relationship to, you know, Judaism as assimilatable into larger society, and as opposed to like the need for Zionism and, you know, having one oppressed people settle or colonize another oppressed people in a way that's totally unforgivable. And, as you know, that's another thing Michael and I share. We both have some, like, I don't have as much as he does, but we both have a Jewish background, and like that really drove a lot of what he was thinking about in terms of why simple narratives about this didn't really work.
I should point out that if you're looking at the screen from right to left, it gets less and less Jewish as you go. I only get mistaken for a Jew, but I'm actually not one.
Is it normally like right wingers who call you a dirty Jew or something? Like,
oh yeah, yeah. No, I've gotten people and an anti-Semitic way many a time.
I mean, right wingers are there are lots of right wingers who are convinced that Matt Crispin is Jewish, even though his last name is literally Christman. But. But yeah, I mean, like, I know that like kind of early epiphany about Zionism was also a big part of Michael's, you know, rejection of standpoint epistemology, right? Because he realized very early on that this game can be played in reactionary directions, and in fact, his first experience of it was in a reactionary direction. That, you know, that like his. Just as easily as anybody can say any other sentence that starts with as a, right? You know, you can start with as a Jew, right? You know, like I understand the importance of having the state and whatever, right? And if you can kind of realize that it's you know, that like it's ridiculous to talk. Well, first of all, it's ridiculous to act as if there's a Jewish hive mind, right? And then
not anymore, you know, right? You guys stop doing that.
there's always been an internationalist, you know, Jewish left. And then like also more than that, you realize that there's something especially ridiculous about you know, about like checking the family background of somebody before you like evaluate, like, you know, with their perspective on something like this, right? Mm-hmm. That's like, there's something just sort of fundamentally corrupt and just irrelevant about that, right? Mm-hmm. Then if you're going to be consistent about that, you have to apply that to everything else too.
Right. I think that's right.
Yeah.
So listen, we've been talking for about an hour. I know that we could go on for another hour, but I'm getting sweaty in this room. So I want to just, I guess ask you both, what you think. I mean, look, there's no way to do this. There's no way to fill in the gap that Michael Brooks has left behind. On the other hand, it seems as though one of the best ways to honor him would be to, I don't know, not exactly make an attempt to do that, but make an attempt to pick up the project in some broad way that he was involved in and he was building and carry it forward. I know that his family is planning to make a foundation so that something like that can happen. I don't know exactly what the details are, but it, you know, we're all three in the online left. What do you think the loss of Michael Brooks tasks us with as we go forward?
You know, something I have thought about in the last few days, and I was thinking about posting this at one point, and then I realized how ironic that would be, is that, like, it's also just kind of petty, but, like, it's not nothing. You know, I think, you know, like, one very small way to, you know, to honor what he cared about would be to be less online, right? That, that, you know, he was a big proponent of logging the fuck off. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, you'll notice he didn't, like, his use of social media was extremely functional, right? Like, he would do, you know, he would post links to things and announcements, you know, about upcoming shows and, you know, and whatnot, right? And he, you know, every once in a while retweet a political tweet, you know, that he liked, but he didn't, you know, he understood how he, you know, he had a correct abhorrence of the medium. So I think that's related, you know, as small a thing as it is, I think it's related to a lot of what we talked about, right? In terms of, like, just how deeply he would read and think about things, you know, when he commented on it, right? You know, he was, obviously he was in the take industry, but, you know, but he wasn't interested in the hotness of the takes, right? You know, mm-hmm. and I think, you know, he would give me shit about reading comments on videos, you know. You know, I think that's one very small thing, but I think more than that, right? Look, I wouldn't try to imitate Michael's particular way of
You. Why wouldn't you? He would imitate you. But anyway, keep going.
Well, I wouldn't do that because I just wasn't as good at it.
Right, I know.
But also, you know, but like, I wouldn't try to emulate exactly the way he did this stuff because, it would be like reacting to liking Shakespeare by trying to write an iambic pentameter yourself, right? You know, you're gonna make an ass of yourself. But I certainly think, you know, just trying your best in whatever way you can to emulate some of the underlying virtues, you know, making yourself less U.S. centric in your analysis, certainly, you know, reading as deeply as he did, you know, trying as hard, you know, as he did to, you know, synthesize, you know, what's right in other perspectives and just trying, you know, to be good, you know, to be good to everybody. You know, I mean, it sounds unspeakably cheesy, but, you know, it has, I remember seeing years ago, Noam Chomsky on Democracy Now, right after he got remarried, and he was talking about being in love in the most Chomsky-ish possible way. He was like, well, it does have the virtue of being correct, you know. That's, you know, like, this sounds unspeakably cheesy, but it does have the virtue of being correct, you know. Just you know, try to be as good to everybody in your life as he was to everybody, you know, everybody in his. And that maxim that Varin quoted earlier, you know, you can't do much better than that, right? Be ruthless with systems, be kind with people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And one thing about that was that I think that the fact that he was not allergic to being alpha or being confident is a key to also understanding his ability to be good to people.
Yeah.
That, not getting caught up in neurotic insecurities is one way to be there and be available to others.
God knows, maybe the meditation helped too.
Yeah. As another person who meditates, yeah, I think it's not a bad thing to do. I know Doug's would be like, oh, God.
I just fall asleep when I try to meditate. I fall asleep even when I try not to meditate. It's
but I was going to say something about virtue because I think it's a good thing for his memory. Mm-hmm. Another thing that Michael and I agreed on, and he would actually encourage me to continue developing, was an interest in virtue ethics. And virtue ethics in specific, because it was about trying to embody a trait that you value as good, and virtue is a strength, right? It's a moral, or even in some cases in the ancient world, it's a physical strength. And he would just say, look at what you want to be, model it, and do it. And that's what, you know, that's what I would say to everyone else. But you can't, like, try to be Michael Brooks to do that. Like, you won't be able to. Michael's Michael, you are you, I'm me, you know, I'm a, you know, a caustic flame throwing jerk a lot of the times, and I'm not gonna not be. It's knowing what you want to be and then knowing the limitations. I think that's something a lot of leftists really need to do, because Michael was really good at like saying, like, yeah, I mean, the systems are screwed up and people are messed up, but that's not an out. Like, it's not. And if we act that way, we'll be better political subjects, and we'll be more successful, and we won't be as dysfunctional, and we'll have probably better lives even when we fail. So, like, that's my takeaway too. I mean, Michael and I disagreed on a lot politically, but like the way he modeled that, you just knew he was a good faith interlocutor. And that's the other thing maybe I'd tell people to be. Go in good faith and, like, listen, even if you know you're not going to be convinced, like, you know, like, even if you know you're going to end up mocking that person, at least listen first. And then you can, like, you know, mock them ceaselessly. But you got to come in willing to listen in the first place. And that was something Michael was good at.
Well, I'm going to do something really obvious, which is I'm going to go through and try to steal some of his guest list. people that were, on his show in the past come on ours. And I'm also, I might not, you know, for their sake, I might wear an Adidas tracksuit while I do the interviews.
You're going to culturally appropriate someone's Slavic uncle?
No, but in all seriousness, I am going to steal his guest list. And
good idea.
Yeah. Because he got some of the very best people on his show. And
speaking of tracksuits, I really can't believe we just spent an hour and 15 minutes talking about Michael Brooks and there was no Sopranos talk whatsoever.
I have to confess, I haven't seen that show. I've just been spending all my time watching Breaking Bad over and over again. Yeah. this is a point of debate between Ben Burgess and myself. I'm a big Breaking Bad fan, and you, Ben Burgess, are not. Is that right?
Wow, gonna help me about that. Yeah, I am.
Right, that's it. That's the end of the broadcast. I'm gonna, just run the clip from The Usual Pop the Left, and we'll leave it there.
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and tea.